And welcome to CJSF 90.1 FM, and we're broadcasting from Burnaby. Today's show is Worm's Eye View Grassroots News, and I'm one of your hosts today, Peter Driftmeyer.
And I'm the other host, Preet Burke.
It'll be a great show. It's starting off with an interview produced by Joanna Wang of Worm's Eye View. She met with the director of the Hope and Shadows project at Pivot Legal.
And I have an interesting piece on the Tamil refugees that are in Canada right now, the asylum seekers. It's an article from the Vancouver Sun, which I'll be reading out.
And then finally, we'll be speaking with Sakura Saunders. She is a mining activist and a community journalist, a community radio producer who has gone to a couple different northern remote Aboriginal reservations and helped them set up their own community radio stations. So I hope you enjoy the show, and we'll keep listening to this. It's John and Roy, Another Moon. The following was produced by Joanna Wang.
Joining us today is Director of Hope and Shadow, Paul Ryan, from Pivot Legal Society. Morning, Paul.
Good morning. How are you?
How are you? Nice talking to you.
Yeah, and you.
First of all, could you please introduce us a little bit about what's Hope and Shadow?
Okay, well, Hope and Shadows is a photography contest, exhibition, and calendar, which is run by Pivot Legal Society here in Vancouver for homeless people and low-income people, primarily people who live in the downtown east side. And it's been running for 7 years. Every June, we hand out 200 single-use disposable cameras to residents of the downtown east side, and people have 3 days to take photographs of their community, positive photos of their family and friends, and 3 days later they return the cameras and we develop them, and then from the results we develop about 4,000 images from the cameras that come back, and we have a community team of judges who choose 40. And 40 of those photos go into the exhibition, and 12 of that 40 goes into the annual calendar, which is sold on the streets of Vancouver by the people who took the photos and who are in them. So it's been, it was originally set up in 2003 as a response or as a reaction to journalists and professional photographers coming down and just snapping shots of people without asking. And generally, the general, even today, the general media coverage of the downtown east side is negative. Whenever there's a story about crime, they'll come down and they'll shoot some photos. This is a reaction to that, to show that there is actually hope in this area, and there are people who believe in their community. And so, when people take a photograph of their friends, they get permission, and everybody is aware of who's taking the photo and what the stories are. And so that's what Hope and Shadows is. It was a reaction to negative coverage of the neighborhood, but as a result, it also gives people pride, and it also gives them work experience and self-esteem when they sell a calendar, and it also gets them a little bit of extra income. Because everyone who sells the calendar has bought it themselves, They buy them for $10 and they sell them for $20 on the streets of Vancouver, and so they are able to make some money for themselves. Last year, 12,000 calendars were sold on the street, and that was $120,000 that local residents earned for themselves. Okay, well, this year's exhibition starts a week after the calendar's launched, and the calendar is launched on October the 5th. And so from the 5th of October, you'll be able to find vendors who we train at local community centres. You'll find them on the streets of Vancouver, primarily outside areas where there's a lot of foot traffic. So think about SkyTrain stations like the corner of Commercial Drive and Broadway, or downtown Granville and West Georgia by the Canada Line station, and London Drugs down there. Outside Chapters, that's a really popular place for people to stand. Generally, the vendors, they start off by being trained on how to sell in a polite way, and good lines on how to sell the calendar. They also, in the last year or so, Van City has come along, and Van City staff have been able to help people in managing their money. So they're told useful tips and hints on how to look after their money and save for something big. We have people who sell a lot of calendars. Some people just sell a few. So it really depends on the individual. Can they earn?
Yeah.
Well, if they're on a disability allowance, which a lot of people are, they're allowed to earn. I think it's $500 a month. And some people aren't on welfare. Some people are just on very low income. So really, this is just a top-up to what people have, other income sources that they might have. Majority of the calendars are sold between October and Christmas, and will sell out by then. There are a couple of vendors who sell. I don't know if people know of Megaphone. It's a street paper that's sold on the streets as well. And some of the vendors sell that every 2 weeks. A new copy of the street paper Megaphone comes out. So that's how much they earn. It really depends on the individual. We don't give people calendars and then they have to come back with the money. They buy them from us and then they go out there and sell them. So we don't control how they go out and manage their money. They're running their own business, and the more they go out, the more they can sell. But we start them off with a free calendar when we do the training. So everybody comes to a session and we show them how to sell, and we give them a free calendar, which is worth $20. They go out there and they can sell it for $20, and if they want to buy more, they come back and buy them for $10. And then if they need any other advice, they come back and they see us. We can direct them towards any services that they might need. But we're not, we don't provide other services. We provide this, and we provide support if they need it in what they're doing.
As we're talking about calendar, what are gripping stories behind the calendars?
Yeah, well, the stories are very gripping. Every calendar, there's a story about who's in the photograph, but also there's a tiny little photograph of the actual person who took the photo and their story as well. So the whole point behind it was to show the rest of Vancouver that there is a community and that there are real people who have families and who care about things in the downtown east side, to put a human face to the people who live there. 2 years ago, a book was published that we published with Arsenal Pulp Press called Hope and Shadows, and it actually won the City of Vancouver Book Award, and it has really in-depth stories about 33 of the people who've been involved with the contest, talking about their lives, and there's also photographs in the book, and that book actually sells for $20 as well. Not every vendor grabs the book to sell. Sometimes some of them do, some don't. But you can buy the book in most bookstores as well across Canada. it's not a new campaign, but the calendar is going to have a fresh look. For the last few years, most people who've seen the calendar will know that it's a black and white calendar. It's a quality art calendar. It has heavy card, and it's always been... The whole idea is that it's a quality product, but it's been black and white. And this year, we decided that we'd mix things up a little bit, and we introduced a few new categories in the contest. And even though we printed in black and white, the actual film is color, so we decided we'd put a few of the color images into the calendar. So the calendar is going to look amazing. We're just about to send it to the printers, and it has an amazing cover, and there are four color images in there, and it's going to look great. So that's something that people should look out for from October the 5th. And then the week later, I think I mentioned before, the exhibition, that's downtown on West Georgia and Hornby. It's going to be in the HSBC building Pendulum Gallery, which is across the road from the Yacht Vancouver Art Gallery. And people can see those images from October the 12th until the 23rd, and they can see the top 40 photos there. So that's if people come into the city. I know you've got students who are at the downtown campus. And it's not too far from the city. The licensing is, we get a license from the City of Vancouver. We also get one from North Vancouver, the City of North Vancouver. So that allows vendors to be on the street, and they can sell the calendar, they can sell the Hope and Shadows book, and also we have some greetings cards that people can sell. And so it allows them to legally go around and vend. So we give them the license. When we do a training session, we have people sitting down. At the beginning of the training session, we take their photograph, and then we sit down with a laptop and a portable printer and a laminator, and while they're being taught on how to sell, we're actually producing their IDs. And then we put their photograph, we put their license number on it, and we print it out, we cut it up and laminate it, and at the end of the session, they've got their free calendar and they've got their license. And so they have to show their license when they're selling. So it's all very organized. In the United States, they have street newspapers where they sell, just like the one here, and they don't have to have licenses down there because it's part of their constitution, the freedom to say what you want on the street. So it's funny how here we do have to be registered, and we get registered, and everyone has a license, and they can't buy the $10 calendar to sell for $20 if they haven't been trained. So we keep an eye on who's doing the selling. It's not just anybody. We do actually take this seriously.
How much funding does government
give? Funding? Well, we don't get too much from. There's been a lot of cuts recently. What with the economic crisis, a lot of foundations used to be able to get grants easily. Most of our funding is privately from sponsors. So every page on the calendar has a logo from an organization that's given us some money to help print the calendar. Individuals give us money. So we get very little government funding. It's mainly from private companies and organizations and individuals. And a lot of the work putting it together is done by volunteers for free. So there's not a lot of government funding in there, which is a good thing. It's good to share our support across from, to get our funding from lots of different areas makes it stronger, because if we were completely reliant on grants, I think we would have had a problem, because the grant funding has actually been cut severely in the last few years.
So how does society manage the money?
Well, the sponsorship helps pay for the production of the calendar, and there's also some money comes back from selling the calendar as well, but obviously from the $20 that somebody might pay for a calendar, $10 goes to the vendor. I think $2, more than $2, maybe $3 goes to tax, the HST. Then we have to pay for the printing of it, which is obviously covered partly with the other one, but we also pay for the framing and the printing of the exhibition. So there's a lot of costs involved, and we manage to break even every year. We put as much as we can into it, and we try and give as much as we can back to the community. So even though the calendar, you know, the sales of the calendar might bring in $240,000, $120,000 goes directly to the people who are in the neighborhood, and the rest of it goes to costs and running it.
Again, we are talking with Paul Ryan, and he is working with Puerto Rico Society, also director of Popping Shadow. Nice talking to you, Paul.
Okay, nice talking to you, Joanna.
Thank you.
Thanks, bye.
காதல் வழியாது கண்ணராகும் வழியாது பூனையில் செல்வம் கிடையாது ஆண்களில் ராமன் கிடையாது புரட்சிகள் ஏதும் செய்யாமல் பெண்ணுக்கு நன்மை விளையாது கண்ணகி சிலைதான் இங்குண்டு சீடைக்கு
And welcome back to Worm's Eye View Grassroots News on CGSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby. That last song was Urvasi Urvasi, composed by and sung by A.R. Rahman, and that was from the 1994 film Catalan.
And I have an interesting selection from the Vancouver Sun, written by Stephen Hume, dated August 26, 2010. Essentially, the article is talking about whether or not the Tamil refugees are taking advantage of Canada. He states that the facts tell a different story. The 492 Tamil refugees arrived by boat, and the clamor over bogus claimants flocking to Canada is because it's so easy to get in and arose once again. How about a few facts? The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees says that there is no upsurge in asylum seekers trying to get into the rich countries of the world. Analyzing its exhaustive statistics, the UN agency says the numbers of asylum seekers remain stable and that while they did increase in some countries, they fell perceptibly in others. 19 countries posted increases, 25 countries registered declines, but on the average, there was little change. Scandinavian countries got the largest number of asylum applications with 51,000 in 2009, and an increase of 13% over 2008, the highest upswing in 6 years. However, refugee claims fell sharply in southern Europe in some places, Italy, for example, by as much as 42%. How about Canada? This country, although commendably ranked third for its acceptance of refugees, saw the number of asylum seekers drop by 10%, mostly due to declining claims from Haiti and Mexico. Germany, on the other hand, recorded a 25% increase, and France, 19%. Canada has a two-track system for assisting refugees. Track one is a resettlement program for refugees seeking asylum from outside the country. These are often refugees who are safe but stranded in camps. About 20 countries accept 100,000 of these refugees a year, and Canada takes 10,000 to 12,000, or about 1 in 10. Track two, the domestic asylum system, provides protection for refugees at risk of torture, cruel or unusual punishment in their homeland who have fled directly to Canada. This number varies from year to year. In 2009, about 34,000 such refugees came to Canada. But to put this in perspective, there were 377,200 refugees, such refugees worldwide that year, and 343,000 sought asylum in other countries. Under the two-track system, once a claim is made, a Canadian citizenship and immigration officer determines whether the asylum seeker is eligible, and if so, refers that the claim to Immigration and Refugee Board for a decision. This is the process of the present Tamil refugee claimants now undergo. So they're being treated in exactly the same fashion as every other refugee. Another complaint about the Tamil refugees is that they came to Canada and didn't go to countries closer to their homeland. But the UN Refugee Agency's latest figures show that of the 146,000 refugees now identified as being from Sri Lanka, about 126,000 did go to the other countries. In fact, 73,000, about half of that, went to India. Tamil refugees seeking asylum are distributed across 57 countries. So there is no playing Canada for the patsy. In fact, Refugee Status Determination Watch, and an American non-government agency that tracks these arcane statistics, says that based on 2007 numbers, Canada's rate for recognizing refugee claims was lower than that of the UN High Commission on Refugees. It says that while Canada's RSD system is considered one of the best by refugee advocates, it granted recognition to 52% compared to a rate of UN High Commission of 79%. Recognition rates vary according to need, however. Canada recognized 81% of applicants from Afghanistan and 84% from Iran. The three highest rates for the three most dangerous regions on the planet, Somalia at 93%, Eritrea at 94%, and Sri Lanka at 92%. Yet the Canadian Council for Refugee notes that only a small minority of refugees over make it to the rich countries of the north. In fact, the humanitarian burden falls most heavily upon the poor. So that was an article from Stephen Hume in the Vancouver Sun, dated August 26, 2010. Peter, what did you think of that article?
I think it's interesting because it was commenting on the common discourse that's even in the media and then dispelling some of the myths that are in the discourse around the Tamil refugees.
I completely agree. I think that in the mainstream media, especially in the Vancouver Sun here in BC, oftentimes the mainstream media has kind of a harsh representation of the refugees, especially the Tamil refugees that come from Sri Lanka. But this was kind of buried within some of the articles that I found online, and it has a critical take on what is going on actually in current times.
Yeah, and it was from, you know, a CanWest paper. And I'm just thinking about some of the other coverage I've seen. Like, I know that a known neo-Nazi, Paul Fromm, has organized rallies against accepting the refugees in, and that kind of gets kind of legitimate coverage in the mainstream media as you know, like local Canadians or local citizens, you know, protest the refugees entering Canada.
Yeah, it kind of just finds its way into mainstream media as the norm or the general idea that this is what everybody believes, so it becomes an overgeneralization. But it's always good to have a refreshing take, a critical point of view of what maybe some of the statistics say on paper.
Definitely. And just to kind of keep with the theme of the Tamil language music from Air Rahman, we got another tune here.
This is Kanalane from the 1990 film Bombay.
Thank you.
This is Worm's Eye View Grassroots News here at CHSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby. Sakura Saunders has long been involved in community radio in the United States, and she is the editor of protestbarrack.net. She has recently been involved in setting up community radio stations in two northern Aboriginal territories, the first in Fort Chipewyan, Alberta, and in Wet'suwet'en territory in BC. She joins me on the phone from Portland. Hello, Sakura.
Hey there, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. Welcome to CHSF. So how did you get involved in building these two stations?
Well, I first got involved by meeting members of the community through my environmental justice activism. So you mentioned, you know, I have a campaign against Barrick Gold, which is the world's largest gold mining company. And through that campaign, I've gotten involved in many other environmental justice movements based in Canada, because Barrick is a Canadian-based company. And so I met Mike Mercury from the Fort Chipewyan community through his advocacy around the tar sands. And then I also met Warner Nazel and Mel Basil from the Wet'suwet'en territories, and Frida as well. I met them at the Everyone's Downstream conference, which is organized around resistance to the tar sands. And so in meeting these communities, you know, we became friends, and then they found out that I was also involved in building community radio stations, and both Mike and Warner especially were interested in having me come to the communities and set something up. And so actually when I helped set up the radio station in Wet'suwet'en territory, it was in the context of an action camp. And what we did was we set up the radio station where there was a camp where we were learning about different forms of direct action, and we set up a temporary camp, which was going to be a permanent camp in the exact site where an Enbridge pipeline wants to be built. But now, of course, once that camp was over, we moved that community radio station to the reserve, the Unist'ot'en Reserve.
And has the station been going, continuing on that reserve after the camp?
They are still doing, they want to be really intentional about the way that they construct the radio station. So at this point, what we did was a number of radio workshops. So we would turn on the station, for example, at the high school graduation party. And we had a lot of the youth practice being on the air and practice doing radio shows and also playing their favorite songs from their iPods, just to get them, you know, kind of involved in the radio station. We also did trainings on, you know, audio editing and things like that. But I really think that with that community, they want to have a system in place before they start doing 24/7 broadcasting. That community very intentionally wants to use the radio station as an educational resource for the community. And so now that they've given the community a taste of what it is to have community radio, they're going to, you know, set some systems in place before they start broadcasting 24/7. But on the other hand, the radio station that I helped set up in Fort Chipewyan, which is a downstream tar sands community in northern Alberta, they're broadcasting 24/7. You know, when there's no live DJ, it's just, you know, iTunes with a number of different playlists on random play. And that community station, you know, it's one of two radio stations, period, in town. And so it not only wants to be an educational resource, but also an entertainment resource for the community. And so, you know, one of the ways they engage the community is they get texts requesting songs and things like that. And, you know, it's largely run by one person who lets other people come in and guest DJ and send in requests. And so that's a radio station that doesn't require as much structure. And so once we set that up, they just ran with it.
That's amazing. And in Fort Chip, what inspired, you mentioned that in the Wet'suwet'en area, it was the action camp that started it. What started it? What was the motivating starting factor for the station in Fort Chip?
Well, I mean, it was this advocate that I mentioned earlier, Mike Mercurdy. He had always dreamed of having a radio station, and, you know, a lot of people are really bored in Fort Chipewyan. It's a community of about 1,300 people, and it's super isolated. The only way to access it during the summer is either by boat or by plane, and during the winter is by an ice bridge or plane. And so it's a very isolated community, and, you know, he really wanted something that people could have fun with, and that would be a really popular source of entertainment and education. And he had been doing some radio announcements about the tar sands, and that's what kind of got him interested in radio. And then he started talking to other First Nations communities through his travels in his advocacy against the tar sands. And through kind of encountering these other First Nations community radio stations, he was really inspired to bring something home. So, of course, as soon as he heard that I was involved in radio station building in the States outside of my environmental justice work, he, you know, invited me to come to the community.
And how did people in this community receive it, the new station?
It was pretty incredible. The radio station's called FCBC, Four Chip by Chip, and, you know, we, like, spray-painted Mike's car and drove around promoting the station in its first couple of days, and his phone was ringing off the hook with texts and with phone calls, people making requests. People were just stopping by the house constantly, making requests, jumping on the radio. You know, I'd pull him into Mike's bedroom, and we'd record public service announcements and just, you know, little announcements saying, you know, you're listening to Four Chip by Chip, FCBC, 107.3 FM. And so the response from the community was great. Everyone loved it. Everyone loved listening to it. Everyone loved hearing the requests. And I just feel like we got a lot of community engagement from the get-go. And people were scheming about, you know, what types of shows they could do. And it was really exciting to see.
And you'd mentioned that in Fort Chip, there was only one other radio station. Do people there have access to other forms of media, whether it's community media or corporate media?
Well, a lot of people in Fort Chip have satellites. So they have satellite radio. There's one other station, which I believe is a CBC station, that's broadcast out of Edmonton originally. And so they do have access to that radio as well, which a lot of people listen to. We actually turned off during Radio Bingo because we actually needed to change. We eventually needed to change frequencies because we're causing a little bit of interference, which we did. We changed frequencies, but you know, a lot of the people access the radio already, even though they only had access to one radio station. And I believe there's other newsletters and things, but mainstream media doesn't have a large presence there, I would say.
And in Wet'suwet'en territory, what's the situation like there in terms of other media access?
In Wet'suwet'en territory, they're close to Smithers, which is a population of 5,000, which is kind of like the big town in the area. So they have access to media through that. Also, there is a First Nations radio station that a lot of people listen to that I believe comes from Prince George. So again, it's non-local. In Wet'suwet'en territory, they used to have a radio station that was run by the First Nation people themselves, but one day somebody came in and stole all the equipment. And so they lost that resource, and a lot of people really appreciated it, especially listening to that radio station. So that's kind of what motivated Warner to get in touch with me. He was the first time we met. He was like, yeah, we used to have a station. Everyone loved it, and all the equipment got stolen. So, you know, we'd really like something in this community to replace the hole that that radio station left.
No kidding. To backtrack, you had said earlier that these two communities are in the spotlight, kind of in regards to their relationship to tar sands development. Fort Chip is downstream from the actual tar sands mines and there are high cancer rates there, and the Wet'suwet'en Nation is opposing the construction of the Enbridge pipeline, which would bring tar sands oil across their territory. How does this factor into what kind of stuff you would hear on the their stations?
Well, definitely, you know, with the Wet'suwet'en station especially, you know, there's a lot of like education work that's being done through the radio station. So, for example, as part of the action camp, we had a rally and march, a really festive march throughout Smithers, which is a big town in the area, and you know, we stopped at various sites within Smithers that are somehow connected to the forestry industry, the mining industry, or the Enbridge pipeline, and also CN Rail, as it's connected to the tar sands. And at each stop, we heard a number of speeches from both local people and folks from other First Nations that came out of solidarity for the Wet'suwet'en people. So those recorded speeches were played on the radio station when we had it running. You know, we went to Radio for All and downloaded a lot of the First Nations radio programming that's available on there, including stuff from Co-op Radio. And so, you know, the Wet'suwet'en people, they're really amazing. Like their analysis really incorporates a lot of solidarity work. So, for example, they actually did a protest in solidarity with the refugees that came in by the boat, the Tamil refugees. Also, they're against carbon credits. And this is one of the things that really impressed me so much about the Wet'suwet'en people when I heard their hereditary chief, Warner, speak about this issue. They're being approached to sell carbon, you know, basically receive money for preserving their own forests. So in a sense, they just get all the positive aspect of these carbon credits. But because they know that those carbon credits will facilitate the expansion and justify the expansion of the tar sands, they are against accepting that money. And so I was just extremely impressed with that community, and they're using the radio station definitely more as an educational piece. In the Fort Chippewyan community, the situation is a little bit different. The radio station isn't as explicitly political. And of course, we slipped in, you know, educational speeches. Many of the speeches actually from the Wet'suwet'en Action Camp were played on the radio, as well as other just spoken word pieces. But definitely the feel for that radio station is not as explicitly political. And the reason that Mike wanted to do it that way is because you know, everyone knows about the tar sands, and everyone doesn't need to be reminded of how destructive it is. You know, when you have a community of 1,300 people and, you know, 40 people have already died from cancer in recent years, you know, you don't need to be reminded of how bad the tar sands are. So it's political in a different way. It's political in the sense that it's a community building project. You know, his aim first is just to get people listening and using it. So that was kind of the impetus behind him wanting to get so many requests and wanting to engage the community on this really kind of simple level. And then, you know, he wants the community members to do shows, and he wants to do announcements about parties and projects that are going on in the area. You know, do classes about the native plants in the region, do classes about, you know, the wildlife of the region, so that that radio station will be largely a community building project, as will the Wet'suwet'en radio station as well. But in terms of broadcasting the negative impacts of the tar sands, I think that it'll just be a lot more subtle.
It definitely sounds like a remarkably empowering process.
It was really fun. I have to say, a lot of people had a lot of fun being on the air and getting comfortable on the air, and it never gets old. It never gets old just, you know, talking to people and having them be really shy at first, and then, you know, seeing the transformation of them becoming total hams on the radio.
Well, we need to let you go shortly, but before we do, I'd like to ask you your opinion. We often hear that radio is dying out, and your stories definitely paint a different picture. What do you think the future of media on reservations looks like?
Well, you know, the idea of radio dying out, you know, I mean, it just depends on what radio is offering, and radio has adapted to be on the internet and be available through via podcasts and lots of other forms. But especially in rural communities, radio is still the cheapest form of mass communication, you know? And everyone has radio stations, and you can't expect a community like Fort Chipewyan for everyone to have, you know, high-speed internet access or even a computer. So I think that radio still has a lot of time where it's going to be extremely relevant as the cheapest form of mass communication, cheaper even than newspapers and print. So, yeah, I just think that all the excitement that radio generated in both these communities is proof that you know, radio is an extremely relevant form of media in lots of the world, especially in rural communities.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Sakura.
Thanks so much for having me.
I have been speaking with Sakura Saunders. She has long been involved with establishing community radio stations in the States. She's also editor of protestbarrack.net, and she recently traveled to the Wet'suwet'en territory of northern BC and Fort Chipewyan in northern Alberta to help establish community stations there. Thank you.
Listening CJSF 90.1 FM Warmside View Grassroots broadcasting Burnaby, and the song title is Convergence from Momentum. It's Momentum.
I just want to thank you all for listening today. I think we got some really good issues, important issues out. There is an important notice from Peter, though.
Oh yeah, that's that. Our show might be changing, or it will. Next week we'll be taking the long weekend off, but you'll hear some repeat of stuff we've made in the past. And then we'll be coming back at a whole new time on a whole new day. Most likely Friday, 10 a.m.
Still the same grassroots content, though.
Yeah, the same grassroots place, same grassroots time. No, sorry, different grassroots time. I was trying to copy Batman there. If you want to reach us at Worm's Eye View Grassroots News, you can drop us an email at wormseyeradio@gmail.com.
Thanks for listening.